Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a cold, hard fact that if you don't get the job done, you probably won't have that job for long. And the higher you move up the corporate totem pole, the smaller the margin of error. In a way, Merrill Lynch CEO Stan O'Neill's fate was probably sealed last week when the bank announced an $8 billion subprime write-off. Today, it's all over but the shout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Monday. It's October the 29th. Rumors that Stan O'Neill wasn't long for Merrill Lynch started bubbling to the surface on Friday. We told you that after that $8 billion in subprime write-downs, O'Neill said he's responsible for the performance of the firm, and the board has apparently decided to hold him to that. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports O'Neill would be the highest-profile casualty of the subprime mortgage debacle.
Last week, Merrill Lynch announced a $2.3 billion loss, one of the worst in its history. The bloodbath stemmed from investments in bundled subprime mortgage securities. Other big banks hedged their bets in subprime and did a lot better.
Merrill Lynch is supposed to be a very cutting-edge, prestigious investment bank, and it just looks like they were totally caught sleeping at the wheel.
David Abella is a portfolio manager at Rockdale Investment Management.
Merrill's loss, the magnitude is just so much greater than the other institutions.
Abella says it's not surprising that the blame for the debacle has reached all the way to Merrill's CEO, Stanley O'Neill. Last week, after wiping out billions of dollars in shareholder equity, O'Neill began unauthorized negotiations for a merger with a rival bank. That deal could have netted O'Neill personally around $250 million. When O'Neill took the reins at Merrill Lynch 5 years ago, he set out to change the firm's corporate culture, making it more aggressive. He laid off almost 15,000 employees and dozens of senior executives left.
As a result, I think he has lost the loyalty of both former as well as current employees.
Winthrop Smith headed Merrill's international brokerage until 2002. He says O'Neill pushed out many top managers who had weathered similar credit crises in the past.
That loss of experience and loss of memory, you know, certainly has had an impact.
And Smith says today it looks a lot like O'Neill is falling victim to the more cutthroat, unforgiving corporate culture he helped create. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Not everybody's suffering on Wall Street, of course. Shares of Goldman Sachs hit a record high today for the 8 years that it's been a public company. Merrill Lynch got a boost, too, up almost 2% at the closing bell. The entertainment industry is not under quite as much pressure as the big investment banks are these days, but it's close. A writer's strike is looming here in Los Angeles. Compensation over digital content is a big sticking point. Program producers and networks are trying to figure out how to beat YouTube and other online video sites. But what really caught our ear today was the telephone industry, which has been working its way into the business of delivering you your television. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains.
If you live in an apartment, you know you usually don't get to choose your cable company. For years, consumer advocates have been petitioning the Federal Communications Commission to strike down a rule that lets cable providers sign exclusive contracts with apartment buildings. A report in today's New York Times suggests that this week, they're about to get what they wanted. For that, you can thank the muscle of the telecom lobby.
Kind of this clash of two titans.
That's Joel Kelsey of the Consumers Union. He says the telephone companies joined the fight against exclusivity contracts because now they're competing with cable. Kelsey says the telecom see TV as
one of the big services that's going to allow them to kind of catapult into the next decade of telecommunication service.
Because the phone company isn't just about phone service anymore. Andy Schwartzman of the Media Access Project says that desire to diversify is sure to translate, in this case, into good news for the public.
The data is very unequivocal. When you have a choice of two providers, the prices go down.
Some reports say as much as 30%. Not surprisingly, Dan Brenner of the National Cable Television Association isn't happy about the impending FCC rule change. He says don't expect your bills to go down just yet.
There's no guarantee that every time these exclusives are eliminated, phone companies are going to offer a competitive product in that building.
And even if they do, the prices will have to drop a whole lot to make up for the 93% they've increased over the last 10 years. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The Supreme Court has decided to revisit the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Almost 20 years on, the justices voted to hear whether ExxonMobil ought to have to pay a $2.5 billion punitive damage award. The original judgment from an Alaska jury back in 1994 was for $5 billion. Down Constitution Avenue a bit, the Federal Reserve's getting ready for a meeting tomorrow to talk about short-term interest rates. 6 weeks ago, Ben Bernanke and the gang obliged Wall Street with a half-point cut. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports investors have their party hats ready once again.
The financial numbers Fed members will be crunching over the next couple days are decidedly mixed. There are a lot of positive things going on in the economy. Strong growth overall, robust exports, low unemployment, and benign inflation rates for everything except food and energy. On the downside, the housing and credit industries may still be in a free fall. Oil prices are adding to the drag, and consumers are beginning to show signs of closing their pocketbooks. Those worries have Wall Street bankers and investors anticipating another interest rate cut from the Fed.
In general, the Federal Reserve does not like to surprise the markets.
Economist Brian Bethune with Global Insight expects the Fed will announce a quarter percentage point cut in short-term interest rates. He sees no inflation threat to give the Fed any concern about lowering interest rates too far.
If we did see a pickup inflation in 2008, then the Fed could lift rates back up again. But at least in the short term, to get us over this critical period, it would seem to be the right way to go to lower rates.
Federal Reserve board members are likely to factor in the expectation of a rate cut, says the chief economist at Bear Stearns, David Malpass.
They may not have the economic urgency to do the cut, but the markets are fully expecting the cut, and I think the housing weakness is enough to push them over to do it. But I don't think they'll go more than that.
That's because by this winter, Malpass expects oil and food price hikes will spark enough inflation to force the Fed to start raising interest rates again. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I don't know, but I don't think anybody's going to have to wait for wintertime for oil prices to go up. Crude hit $93.80 a barrel today at one point before settling to $93.50 at the close. Investors didn't miss a beat, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Stan O'Neill may well lose his job at Merrill Lynch over subprimes. The Fed may or may not cut interest rates on Wednesday because of subprimes. But the very banks that led the way into those risky credit investments seem to have found a silver lining in it all. You know that super fund they're setting up to get some liquidity back into the system, $100 billion worth? There's a report out today saying the banks could pull down more than $1 billion in fees from managing it. Commentator Tyler Cowen says American banks have managed to protect themselves from the subprime crisis even better than you might have imagined.
We've all heard about the defaults on subprime mortgage loans. But so far, the real story is how little the broader American economy has suffered. That's partly because of sophisticated trading networks. More than ever before, banks can spread their financial losses very broadly, including to foreigners. In the old days, banks lent out mortgage money and kept those loans on their books. If enough borrowers couldn't repay, the bank went out of business. That was a big problem in the Great Depression of the 1930s. Today, banks usually sell their loans to third parties. This is called securitization. You might have originally borrowed money from Wells Fargo, but now a bank overseas cashes your mortgage checks. If a large group of people can't pay their mortgages, they may lose their homes. But the banks don't suffer as they used to. Local American lenders have already converted those loans into cash and sold off their risk. In fact, German regional banks suffered some of the most significant losses from bad American mortgages. Other European and Asian banks and hedge funds took their lumps as well. American banks essentially bought insurance by exporting their risk overseas. So far, we don't know the total damage from subprime failures, but it probably is less than 1% of the American economy. Those are big losses if concentrated in a few institutions, but the global or even the U.S. economy can handle them. Lots of American domestic banks have suffered losses, but there have been no massive failures. Now, European real estate markets are weakening. Soon, some American banks will be returning the favor and bearing some losses for others. But we're still better off for sharing our risks, and that is why most U.S. stock prices remain high. You're hearing lots of bad economic news from the media. The secret is that we're learning to cope with it better each time.
Tyler Cowen is professor of economics at George Mason University. His latest book is called Discover Your Inner Economist. When you do discover your inner economist, tell us about it. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. If you happen to catch 60 Minutes last night, you saw French President Nicolas Sarkozy walk out on Leslie Stahl. You can't blame the guy for being frustrated, personally or professionally. He and his wife are getting a divorce. His attempts to reform the French pension system have done little but prompt massive strikes. Earlier this month, railway workers essentially shut down Paris. Air France flight attendants walked out over this past weekend. And there could be more. Sarkozy's promised to go after rules protecting chemists, lawyers, and taxi drivers. John Lawrenson reports now, curbside in Paris.
Hi there, I'm doing a piece about getting taxis in Paris.
It's impossible, it's not difficult.
So how long do you have to wait in the mornings to get a taxi? It's quite tricky.
Can be like half an hour or more.
I've waited here 30 minutes.
In the morning, in the evening, after a night out, and of course when it rains, it's hard, if not downright impossible, to find a taxi in this city. There are considerably fewer cabs in Paris today than there were in the 1920s because of strict limits on new licences set by the drivers themselves. There's a 17-year wait for a free licence to drive a taxi in Paris. Otherwise, it'll cost you €185,000, $263,000. And the price is much higher still in Montpellier, Nice or Marseille.
The taxi market in France is a symbol of everything which goes wrong in France. You have to pay for working.
That's economist Jacques Delplat, co-author of the reformist manifesto The End of Privileges. He's a member of a commission set up by President Sarkozy to identify barriers to economic growth. Its final recommendations are due next month.
Because more businessmen, tourists, are asking for taxi, the business is expanding, but the number of people in the game are not. It hurts the consumers, it hurts business people, and it hurts job creation.
I finally get a cab and get talking to the driver. He tells me he works 70 hours a week to pay off his license. The job's a nightmare because of the traffic, and it's the traffic, not the lack of taxes, he says, that makes it difficult to find a cab. It's the same message from Alain Estival, president of France's biggest taxi union.
There are 200 kilometers of traffic jams in and around Paris every day. The taxis are out there, but they're stuck in the jams.
It is true that Paris has about the same number of taxis as, for example, London has black cabs. But London also has tens of thousands of minicabs. France's reformers say buying the taxi licences back at market price and deregulating the business would create 150,000 new jobs. Union leader Estival told me they already saved France once, when Paris's taxis brought troops to the front in the First World War. They're not going to sacrifice themselves again to save the French economy.
Des embouteillages, des rues bloquées, de forts ralentissements. Les chauffeurs de taxi ont réussi.
Taxi drivers on the news, blocking traffic in cities around the country late last month. If Sarkozy presses ahead with the reform, France's taxis will be driving to the front line again. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Allez, bon courage, hein. Au revoir.
Coming up.
I also invented the friggin' iPod. Have you heard of it?
Steve Jobs. The fake one, that is. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks rose today on Wall Street ahead of a possible rate cut by the Fed later this week. The Dow Industrials rose 0.4%, about 63 points, to close at 13,870. The NASDAQ moved up 0.4%, 13 points, to close at 2817. The S&P 500 gained 0.3%, 5 points, to end the day at 1540. Crude oil, as I mentioned, closed above $93, a record high. Shares of Chevron motored up 1.3%. Radio Shack dialed in a 4% gain after reporting strong quarterly profit. Shares of Office Depot, though, they got a shredding today. They lost 14% after announcing a possible accounting irregularity that'll delay earnings. Overseas markets were mostly higher. Britain's FTSE advanced 0.2%. The French CAC 40 rose more than 0.2%. Germany's DAX gained 0.75%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduced costs for business. AAFP.org/value. And by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. President Bush meets with the president of Uganda. They'll discuss leadership in Somalia and malaria and HIV/AIDS issues. A House subcommittee looks at the impact of higher postal rates on small businesses. And on this day in 1953, General George C. Marshall won the Nobel Peace Prize for his European Recovery Program, now known as the Marshall Plan. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak went on national television in Cairo today to talk about nuclear power. He wants some of it. Mubarak announced Egypt's going to restart its civilian nuclear power program that was shelved after Chernobyl back in 1986. Nuclear power is making a comeback here, too. Tomorrow, the Tennessee Valley Authority is expected to submit plans for a new reactor in Alabama. It'll be the second application for a new plant in the past month and a half. The nuclear industry is already in line for $12 billion worth of government subsidies to finance those plans. And Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, power companies are pushing for even more.
When CEO David Crane stepped up to the microphones on Capitol Hill last month, he proclaimed the day truly historic. His company, NRG Energy, had just filed the first application to build a new nuclear power plant in the U.S. in nearly 30 years.
It's important for all of us to recognize that that was then and this is now. The nuclear industry today is not the nuclear industry of the 1970s.
Why should the American people be subsidizing something that hasn't worked for 50 years?
Stop him. What's that sound? Everybody look at what's going on.
Well, some things haven't changed since the 70s. That's a protest video running on YouTube by longtime anti-nuke celebs Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown. They want to draw attention to the industry's aggressive comeback plans and behind-the-scenes efforts to win more government subsidies. The industry wants to expand loan guarantees for so-called clean energy power in the Energy Act of 2005. That program was originally limited to $2 billion. Nuclear lobbyists are now pushing for $50 billion.
That would be an unprecedented level of subsidy to any energy source.
Tyson Slocum is a consumer advocate with Public Citizen. He says given the nuclear industry's history of cost overruns and delays, that's too big a gamble for American taxpayers.
And it's not just Public Citizen that feels it's risky. The Congressional Budget Office estimated back in 2003 a 50% default rate on construction of new reactors.
Critics are even more alarmed at a provision slipped into a Senate bill that would allow the Department of Energy to approve as many loan guarantees for nuclear reactors as it wants. That's a change from current law, where each year Congress authorizes the amount. Critics fear there will be less public debate if the decision is made in the executive branch. Other so-called clean energy projects like wind and solar would benefit from the loan provision as well, but it would be up to the Energy Department to determine the amount of loan guarantees. Mitch Singer, a spokesman for the nuclear industry, says nuclear is just more expensive.
These plants are expected to cost anywhere from $3.5 to $5 billion each. What this will do, it ensures that the loan volume is available, that it reflects the high costs of these projects, and is not subject to a yearly appropriations battle.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission expects four more license applications by the end of the year and another 14 in 2008. David Crane, NRG's CEO, says other energy sources deserve government support too, but he argues they can't deliver as reliably or as much power as nuclear can.
We support wind, we support renewables, in general we support conservation, but they're no substitute for baseload generation in the United States at this point. It's either coal or nuclear.
Wall Street has lobbied for generous loan guarantees for nuclear power as well. Lenders don't want to get stuck holding the bag if a nuclear project falters. Of course, one of the biggest gifts Congress could give the nuclear industry, says UC Berkeley's Dan Kamen, is a tax on carbon.
In that context, a nuclear plant looks like a far better deal than almost anything else.
Nuclear reactors don't emit greenhouse gases, and more policymakers now sing nuclear's praises as an effective way to fight global warming. The industry's detractors hope they can silence that chorus before a nuclear renaissance even begins. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The beauty of the internet is that you can be anybody you want to be. That's bad in some ways, of course, but in others it's good, and it's funny too. For the past year and a half or so, Dan Lyons has decided to be Steve Jobs. Not the real one, of course, but a guy called Fake Steve Jobs on a blog of the same name. He was unmasked as the author this past summer, wrapping up a mystery that's had the tech world on a whodunit for 14 months. Now he's got a book out as Fake Steve called Options. Dan, good to have you here.
Oh, thanks. Nice to be here.
First question that comes to mind is really why? I mean, you've got a full time job and a busy life, right?
I have 2-year-old twins, really busy life. Yeah. Why? I know. Okay. Basically, you know, I'm a print journalist in an old 90-year-old print magazine, and I realized a few years ago, like, man, I've got to learn about the internet, and nobody on the internet side wants to hire old, you know, print guys at all. So I thought, well, I'll do this on my own. And at the same time, I was thinking all these CEOs were doing blogs. The idea was, the premise was that they were supposed to be also honest and, you know, transparent. But they weren't. They were all just complete spin and more hoo-ha, right?
Yep.
So I thought, but wouldn't it be cool if a CEO really did do a blog, but like went off the rails and like the PR people couldn't stop him. And he just, you know, when the Wall Street Journal wrote something bad about him, he could like say bad stuff back about them and, you know, say, well, you know, whatever, I don't want to use a bad word. But they're, you know, difficult.
Did you try out a couple of different persona? I mean, did you go through, you know, Jeff Immelt, the GE? Nah, that one didn't work. Bill Gates? Yeah, no, that one didn't work. And finally, boom, the light comes on and it's Steve Jobs.
I did. Well, I had a few different candidates. Sergey Brin at
Google, sure.
But you know, there's not a lot of there. You know, not a lot there. And Chris Anderson at Wired, I tried him, the long tail guy, but again. And suddenly I thought, oh, Jobs, you know, like.
Well, he's so perfect for parody, right? Because,
yeah.
I mean, he's got almost the uniform that he wears at the Macworld conferences.
Yeah.
He's so removed from you know, ability to get in touch with him somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, he just lends himself to being taken apart in a kind of a visceral way.
I started reading more about him and reading biographies. Yeah, and he's super controlled, really uptight.
And controlling.
And controlling. But you know that behind the scenes, there's a lot boiling up in there, you know? And because he leaves that empty, he leaves this vacuum, you can fill it fictionally. You can fill it and you can make it ring true. Yeah.
Do me a favor, and I've actually got the book here. It's designed not unlike an iPod. It's nicely packaged yeah. and all that. I want you to just read a little bit here that I've sort of outlined for you.
Okay, so I'm famous for being a genius and for running the coolest consumer electronics company in the world, which I totally started in my garage by myself
or actually with this other guy, but he's out of the picture now, so who cares? I'm famous because the devices I create are works of art, machines so elegantly crafted and industrially designed that they belong in a museum. My iMac computers and iLife software restore a sense of childlike wonder to people's lives and bestow upon their owners a sense that they are more intelligent and even, well, better than other people. I also invented the friggin' iPod. Have you heard of it?
We wouldn't be having this conversation without the iPod, right?
Exactly. And Apple wouldn't have a bigger market cap than IBM today without the iPod.
So, I mean, for all of his foibles, the guy's done some amazing things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a genius. That's the other thing. That's, you know, I'm a huge fan of his. Like, I tell people, I wouldn't want to work for him. I wouldn't want to live next door to him or be in his family. But I'm so glad he's in the world. I mean, he's a genius. He's like an amazing – because I think really at heart, all he really wants to do is work. Even as an Apple user, I'm kind of like, leave me alone. Let me keep making these products.
Fundamentally then, he's just a geek. He's just a Silicon Valley geek.
Absolutely. Only a cool geek.
I mean, well, cool. You know, the coolest, probably.
The coolest of all the geeks. He is, yeah, absolutely. He's one of the only ones who manages to both be a geek and cool.
The book is called Options. It's a parody by fake Steve Jobs, who by day, or by night, I suppose, take your pick. When do you write, day or night?
The fake Steve thing?
Yeah.
A little of both, sort of all day long. Yeah, yeah. You have to keep it churning all day. That's
Dan Lyons works at Forbes. He's a senior editor there. Dan, thanks a lot for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. By Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, if you've ever wondered what might make competitors like NBC and Fox join forces, we have that answer for you today. It's a common enemy called YouTube. The companies have gotten cozy in an effort to take down the popular video sharing site. They say that in almost so many words, by the way. Their big idea is a new site called Hulu.com. It's all studio-produced content. New shows, old ones, movies, pretty much anything they can throw up there. It's all free, but you are going to have to watch the ads to get to it. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow scooped up 63 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ lifted 13 points, also 0.4%. The S&P 500 jumped 5 points. That's 0.3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, lattes and lyrics. It's a potent brew for Starbucks.
They're probably hoping that I'm going to go away, but I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not. This is a guy with a dream. I am the singing Rocky.
And I am Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.